wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, broadcasting here at 90.7 and streaming everywhere at kboo.fm. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. Today's Old Mole Variety Hour looks at issues related to the climate emergency and climate justice, and that covers just about everything, including energy, labor, housing, and gender. On today's show, Bill Resnick talks with Marie-Rose Turek of the Utility Justice Campaign of Oakland, California, about claiming local control of energy, taking it away from Pacific Gas and Electric, you know, the folks responsible for all those fires. Joe Clement introduces words from labor activist Barbara Mattaloni about how to organize and win. Desiree Helliger shares some field recording from the December 21st Portland Homeless Persons Memorial Day Vigil and the life and death stakes about the life and death stakes in the upcoming city council vote on a $22.5 million five-year contract to sweep the city's houseless encampments. And finally, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, The Left and the Law, discuss some of 2019's high-profile sexual harassment cases against powerful men. And they comment on Bombshell, the feature film based on the story of sexual harassment at Fox News. Our shows are archived on the KBOO website. You can find the posts of weekly shows and individual segments a day or two after broadcast by going to our page at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. While you're there, you can subscribe to our show, and we invite you to friend or follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com if you have questions, comments, or suggestions. We turn first today to Bill Resnick's conversation with environmental justice activist Marie-Rose Turek, coordinator of the Utility Justice Campaign at the local Clean Energy Alliance.
Marie-Rose Turek, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Wonderful to be on your show.
Marie-Rose Turek is the coordinator of the Utility Justice Campaign based in Oakland, California. Its mission is to mobilize a broad coalition of climate justice groups, also social justice advocates, ratepayers, and in fact, all the allies they can find. They're seeking a public accountable takeover of the investor-owned monopoly utility PG&E, which is a very different company, has no relation to PGE in the Portland area, except both are pretty predatory. PG&E has been caught. PG&E is now in bankruptcy for its negligence and mismanagement, yet still it's brazenly seeking a bailout that would shift the cost of the wildfires it caused and gas line explosions that it caused for negligence. Wants to shift those costs to the taxpayer. In contrast, the state takeover of PG&E, there's some support for that in the state legislature. Let's hope it becomes a great majority. The takeover could over time create an equitable, sustainable, decentralized restructuring of California's energy system, which is continuing a trend that's occurred throughout the 21st century. Marie-Rose, beating PG&E and its financiers is a big job. I know you're up to it, because for 25 years, Marie-Rose Turek has organized environmental justice campaigns for clean air, for affordable housing, for renewable energy, and climate solutions in local, state, national, and even international arenas, including with the California Environmental Justice Alliance. Marie-Rose, tell us about the communities and people you represent and their concerns about energy supply and PG&E.
Well, I grew up in an environmental justice community, one of the most polluted and disinvested communities in California. And so from there, I've found friends who are not taking it lying down, but really promoting solutions that can help people out of those environmental impacts as well as economic hardships. And so I have worked with dozens of environmental justice groups throughout California and the Southwest and Northern Mexico in that 25 years. And I know that community organizing is what will change these dire conditions that we experience on the ground. And so the Utility Justice Campaign of California is doing just that. Who are the most impacted? Who have the most to lose when it comes to dirty energy, corporate energy, and the fires and electricity shutoffs that this corporation, PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, is causing? And so those are who make up the leadership of the Utility Justice Campaign. We have a lot to lose if we don't change who PG&E is and what disaster they're causing in our communities and throughout California.
One of the reasons they're in bankruptcy is they've got this outmoded electrical system that once was functional in the 20th century as it developed. Now it's completely outmoded.
So PG&E and their power lines are nearly 100 years old, and same with oil refineries that are 100 years old. And so we know that this old fossil fuel industry is dying, it's collapsing, it's catching fire, it's causing disasters in our communities, and we won't take that. It's also part of the climate collapse, is that these old industrial operations are collapsing, and we welcome that. It's that we have to make sure that our communities, the most vulnerable communities, low-income communities of color, those who are medically vulnerable, have options to be well and to stay intact through this big crisis and change, climate-wise and as industries collapse. The reason why PG&E is in bankruptcy is this big corporate model has centralized all of their profits to their shareholders. They centralize energy generation. So there's big dirty gas power plants in California that poison people, our people that live around them. And their transmission lines are dilapidated. They're so old, they're falling down. Even though they're supposed to change them, many are decades and decades old. And PG&E has not prioritized fixing those lines, renewing them so that they function safely. Instead, they've pocketed those profits from customers, customers like me and others in Northern California. And instead of using their funds to make sure that they provide a safe, reliable grid.
After the gas line explosions and many fires, actually, in the last few years, nothing, though, like the last 2 years, 86 deaths in one of them. They were ordered by the court, in fact, who use a supply of money of their surplus to rehabilitate and securitize their grid and their pipelines. Instead, they violated the court order and paid out very large dividends to their stockholders, which Wall Street was demanding. They paid out that money to themselves as bonuses and also to their stockholders.
Yes, so the courts can order them to actually fix the damage that they caused, whether it's the gas pipeline explosion in San Bruno or the fires that they've set in the Sonoma County area and Paradise, way northern California. And instead, they'll drag their feet, they'll prioritize corporate shareholder dividends first. They won't do what the court tells them. They've killed so many good energy justice, environmental justice bills that relate to energy in the California legislature because they have high-powered lawyers, high-powered lobbyists, and high-powered donors who donate to just about every politician in California, and also have many policy people and lawyers who engage the California Public Utilities Commission, who is our regulatory agency, to oversee the utilities like PG&E. And so this corporation, with their money, has figured out how to game the system. And that's what we're dealing with when lives are at stake and cities are on fire, is that PG&E knows how to get away with it. And so that's why we need a campaign that is very organized with the people who have the most to lose and the most to gain for changing our utility system based on this corporate model that PG&E has.
You're gaining a lot of support. My sense is because public power in California, from the municipal utilities and then from the new community energy agencies that are springing up all over, is much more stable and cheaper than what PG&E is now charging.
Well, we definitely want lower rates for especially low-income people. There are programs for our low-income customers now called the CARE program under PG&E, but it's such a tiny amount. A friend of mine says it's like a 50-cent coupon for $80 worth of groceries. That's nothing. So why are rates so high? It's also because the big energy users, like the corporations and the big offices and the big buildings, get a rate that's much lower than those residential customers. We have lots of opinions about the rate structure for how much people pay for electricity and gas. And I think that's part of why municipal or public or cooperative model of an energy system or utility company makes more sense, is that we would have more of an ability to help influence those kinds of discussions and decisions about who's paying how much and why, and the humanity around that. And a more democratically run energy and utility system would help us do that. And if that structure is a municipal system, then that's much better than a corporate structure that PG&E has.
This is Bill Resnick for the Ulmo Variety Hour on Cable Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Marie Rose Turek of the California Utility Justice Campaign. It's seeking a state takeover of the bankrupt monopoly utility PG&E. We have so far discussed mostly why PG&E should be put to rest. Marie Rose, one of the sound bites that I've gathered from your website is from monopoly utility to community power. Tell us what the Utility Justice Campaign wants in an energy system and why local power is, in fact, so attractive.
So environmental justice groups, frontline communities and workers value energy as a resource. And I think the reframe around that is about energy and electricity even being a human right, especially for people who need electricity to live, folks on breathing machines, folks on dialysis, et cetera. And so the way energy and electricity is provided now is that it's a commodity. Do you have money to pay for it? And those are who has access to electricity. And so to us, even the reframe around electricity being a human right is important. So how do you design an energy system that would get us closer to that? We know that also decisions that are made far away from us is very likely to go against us. And so we want community local energy that's democratically run because we want those decisions to be closest to the people who are impacted by them. The energy system that we are putting our heads together on to help the state of California restructure the corporate PG&E utility model, there are many factors. What kind of energy is generated and distributed through communities that need them is one. And based on communities and organizations that the Utility Justice Campaign has worked with, these are the communities that have been fighting big gas, dirty power plants in their neighborhoods. We want to change that reality. Environmental justice and stopping the poisoning, especially of low-income communities of color, need to be stopped in the new energy model that we have. So how are we not just promoting renewable, clean energy, but also that we want to have access to that locally? And the best renewable energy is one that actually is probably on your rooftop if you're in a place where the sun is shining a lot, and we do live in the Golden State. We think those kinds of energy systems where it's on our rooftop, we don't need massive transmission lines to be able to access the energy that we generate on our roof. And so those kinds of access to energy, the type of clean energy, the energy that doesn't require long transmission lines that can catch fire, are some of the better models of energy that we would want to see. I think there's also many parts to designing an energy system that would work for low-income communities of color. And those involve not just distribution lines, but also decision-making. How does decision-making happen? What's the ownership structure of this new system? What happened to workers? And do they have a say in how our new energy system works? One of the things that's happening right now in California is there are many proposals that are being introduced by mayors, by state legislators, by policy wonks. And to us, a lot of these proposals have to do with ownership. So public takeover or co-op model or Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway corporate model. And to us, that's just one piece of the energy model that we have to figure out. So our collection of frontline community leaders is looking at the energy system in a more comprehensive way, looking at it from the legacy of poisoning that is currently our electricity and gas system in California. And we want to transform that so that it's clean, it's local, it's democratically run, and we'll adapt to the changing conditions under the climate crisis, whether those are wildfires or other conditions that are local to our communities and ecosystems in Northern California.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Marie Rose Turok of the California Utility Justice Campaign that's seeking a state takeover of the bankrupt monopoly utility, PG&E. We've talked about the multiple problems of PG&E. It's actually a criminal utility. In fact, it's on probation in the courts, and it's been violating court orders, but it seems to be able to get away with that with impunity. Marie Rose, PG&E is very, very powerful. You explained why. They have vast amounts of money. They have contacts and support from their financiers. Utilities are a debt industry. That is, they go deeply into debt and they buy bonds from the biggest financial companies in the world. Goldman Sachs and all of the others are invested in PG&E and others, and they want their dividends, and they're demanding that in this bankruptcy that they not pay any of the costs that PG&E has incurred, and especially the vast costs of all of the homes and, in fact, the number of people killed and the property damage, which is probably close to $50 billion now. They refuse to accept any of that liability. How are you going to beat them? They're quite powerful. Governor Newsom is very ambitious. He wants to be a national player. He's already sort of a presidential contender for a Democrat. 4 years from now or 8 years from now, he's a young, well-spoken fellow. To be very careful about supporting the big financial firms in Wall Street. How are you going to beat them?
Well, PG&E is weak right now. Like you said, they are criminals in the eyes of the court, and PG&E filed for bankruptcy. So this is the opening that we have in the landscape, is that PG&E is at the weakest it's ever been, that courts have to tell them that they have to restructure their corporate organization, and that the governor is weighing in on that, as well as many others, including dozens of mayors and city council people and local government people. And in California, we also have a very powerful and organized environmental justice movement. The environmental justice movement has been able to pass dozens of new laws in the last 5 to 10 years because we have been doing our homework as advocates on the ground in the communities, organizing with decision makers around our solutions to the biggest problems on the ground. And so we have a pretty organized state policy arm to our movement that also has the ears of state legislators and folks in our state capital. We're able to be successful because we know that the campaigns and the policies that we take on are a matter of life and death. And so when you have people who have lost family members who are poisoned because PG&E sets fire to their cities or poisons their children, you have people who are going to fight for their families to live and to thrive and to not be sick because of corporate polluters like PG&E. That's how we're going to fight PG&E and this big corporation, is with big heart, with organizing prowess, our ability to now write policy with legislator friends in the Capitol. And we're not going to take no for an answer. And that's what's going to help us win.
Marie Rose Turok of the California Utility Justice Campaign. Keep up the good work. Thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill. It was a pleasure.
It was singing, ain't no power like the power to be, because the power to be don't stop. Ain't no power like the power to be, because the power to be don't stop. No.
That That was a bit of Laura Love's Ain't No Power. And before that, Bill Resnick talking with Marie-Rose Turek of the Utility Justice Campaign about what the power of the people can do to fight PG&E. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, streaming at kbu.fm. I'm Fran Michelle. Later on today's show, we'll hear from Desiree Heligers about sweeps of houseless people's belongings and lives, and we'll hear from the Left and the Law about powerful men's sexual harassment. Next, we turn to Joe Clement, introducing some wisdom about the power of the people.
Well, in April of this year, the Labor Notes Troublemakers School came to Portland. The Troublemakers School is a series of popular education-styled forums and workshops by radical worker-centered unionists for workers of unionized and ununionized contexts. Old Mole Denise Morris and myself were there. Denise caught this great audio from Barbara Mataloni, former president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, talking about why strikes work. I pulled this out as a special highlight from the previous year because I think this is a great example of the kind of community popular education that KBOO helps transmit. And Old Mole Denise Morris has produced some great field recordings in recent years. Barbara speaks to so many of the important themes of our political and social crises today. Collective consciousness, experiencing our own power, solidarity on the job and in the communities we serve, and a vision of labor for the public good. These are all crucial ingredients for the next decade if we are to take control of society and the economy and direct it away from this ecocidal, suicidal system of capitalism.
Hi, good morning, sisters and brothers. So excited to be here. So first, in terms of the broader context that we're experiencing, is that we've been dealing with an intense pressure to privatize the public good. We feel that every day. We see it in transportation, we see it in healthcare, we see it everywhere. Is first of all to insist on a scarcity budget. We use the word austerity, and the idea is there's just not enough money out there to fund our public schools, our public transportation, public health care. Now, we all know that's a lie. You know, we remain one of the wealthiest countries in the world, and it's really become sort of just accepted as part of the narrative that we just don't have the money, because they're not just interested in underfunding it, but they want to create a narrative that says that it should be underfunded because they want to destroy it, is that they use testing as a weapon to prove that students are unable to perform, that teachers are not doing a good job, that schools are failing. Charter schools are a key piece of the alternative that they offer to say, see, public isn't working, so we need to go private. And really, charter schools, you know, depending on where you are, in Massachusetts, we were able to successfully beat down a ballot question that would have raised the cap on charter schools. But if you're in places like Chicago, like LA, like New Orleans, Philadelphia, charter schools are taking over the public schools. And they're doing that, like, literally. Because as much as charter schools are about undermining public education, they're also about a land grab. They're about taking property from the public good and using that property for private interests. And what you see happening in Chicago is they close public schools, they maybe put a charter school in, and maybe they actually convert that into gentrified housing, so they can push the black and brown people out. I think about how abstract that can seem. We're talking about large forces at work, about austerity and this and that. But the reality for educators, you feel the austerity budget. You feel the larger class sizes. You feel the work intensification. You feel the narrowing of your curriculum and your capacity to act towards your best ideals as an educator and what brought you into this work. You feel your students who are struggling. It's a visceral experience every day. When I was president of the MTA, I would talk to teachers, and they would say to me, the question is, do I cry in the morning, or do I cry at the end of the day? Do I cry before I go into work because it's just too much, or do I cry at the end of the day because it's been too much? This is a material reality that people are experiencing every day, and that's a key part, I think, of why we're finally, people are fed up, because the bad guys have gone too far. and people who sort of thought, well, this is just the way the world is, are starting to go, it's not okay that this is what the world is. You know, we come into this work with a set of ideals and hopes and possibilities. And to see those crushed every day, people are really ready to say, it's enough. Now, if you look over the past year and a half, there are sort of two different things that have happened that have led to the strikes. We have the sort of red state revolt, and we have the blue state organizing to push back against the Democrats who've been selling us down the river for years and years. But, you know, a lot of that also has to do with whether or not you actually have collective bargaining. So how these strikes were structured is really important. But in Chicago in 2012, in UTLA just this spring, in Oakland this spring, in Denver, I'm sure in where you were working within the context of the union and the union leadership to say we need to organize ourselves for a strike. And we need to set up networks, and we are going to use the union resources to do that. In West Virginia, in Oklahoma, in Arizona, it did not come from union leadership. In West Virginia, the union leadership eventually was like, oh, there's a parade. You know, they're like running with the banner to get out in front of it and call it theirs. But the West Virginia teachers started their organizing because they started just talking to each other. And in fact, I'll tell you, like I know from talking to the leaders of the strike down there, the union leadership actually brought them into rooms and said, cut it out. We got it taken care of. We have a relationship with the legislators, right? You all know about those relationships and how effective they are. It's happening right now in Oregon, right? You got a supermajority, and they're cutting, their budget is less. That's how good that works, right? So they organize themselves. They did incredible work with their strike prep, making sure that the students were going to be taken care of. They went out and they talked to churches and community centers, and they said our kids have to be fed, because something like 80 to 90% of those kids in West Virginia only get their food from the school. So they brought the community in. They go out and strike, and then the leadership of the three unions go talk to the legislators, and they come back after 5 days. And they say, we've got a deal. We're going to get a 5% salary increase for teachers and paraprofessionals, support staff, and we're going to get a 3% for public sector workers, because the teachers had said, this is about public sector workers, about all of us. Said, isn't that great? And they said, back to the table, they refused to settle until everybody got 5%. Mm-hmm. So that's the nature, the solidarity that they built and their political consciousness about what they were fighting for, both in the coalitions with the parents and taking care of the kids, and refusing to settle until everybody was going to get something. So what do we learn from these strikes, though? Because even though they're very structurally different, Arizona, West Virginia, Oklahoma, really rank and file. And UTLA, Chicago, Oakland are examples here of structured leadership development. But here's some things I think are true for everybody. These strikes are about teaching members to access their power. And we don't talk about power enough. We need to think about our power and bring it into our consciousness, and we need to give people opportunities to experience their power on a regular basis. When people act collectively in the smallest way that we first ask them to act, that changes them. When you walk into a room and everybody's got a red shirt on, you're a different person in that room than you were when you were in your classroom alone. All of these strikes are successful because they talk to the community and they have the community on their side. West Virginia put public sector unions demands on the table. Not just teachers. They developed some sort of political consciousness and connections in their work. In West Virginia, people started going, well, where is the money? And then they're like, oh, it's over there in all those tax exemptions that the gas and oil company get. That's where the money is. And so people started to see the political structures and be able to speak back against the austerity stuff. But I think really, really important is that they built connections with each other. It wasn't top down. It was, we're going to bring you together in a room, and we're going to talk about our issues, we're going to develop an analysis, we're going to understand our power, and we're going to use that power to fight back. Strikes work, and we win, but they don't change the world, like right away, right? We did not destroy capitalism in LA and create a new socialist city. I mean, we just didn't get there. And, you know, but I'm a little disappointed.
I hear it all the time.
But it's really important, because people are going to, like, you put so much energy into the strike and you feel your power, and then the world still needs you to continue to act and change. And the things we need to help us do that I've seen in the strikes, is these relationships that sustain us, and a political analysis that you're not just fighting one boss, you're fighting the whole idea of a boss. And when we know that, we'll understand why, after we win, the boss can come back and hit us so damn hard. Mm-hmm. But we know that that's because we're powerful, not because we're weak. Thank you.
When our cause is all triumphant and we claim our Mother Earth and the nightmare of the present fades away, we shall live with love and laughter, we who now are little worth, and will not regret the price we have to pay. But we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when each man can live his life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all in the commonwealth of toil that is to be.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on 90.7 KBOO Portland. And that was Ralph Chaplin's song, Commonwealth of Toil. And before that, Barbara Mattaloni on Strikes That Win, recorded by Denise Morris and introduced by Joe Clement. We'll close out today with The Left and the Law on some of 2019's high-profile sexual harassment cases against powerful men, including questions of differing legal strategies and their political implications. But we turn now to Desiree Heliger's, with audio from the recent Homeless Persons Memorial Day vigil and a report on the real life and death stakes in the upcoming city council vote on a $22.5 million 5-year contract to sweep the city's houseless encampments.
My name is John Mayer. I used to help run the Sunnyside Community House, partnering with Pat Schweibert. I was just telling about my friend Debbie Beaver. She passed away in July. She'd been living in a tent with her husband of 27 years. Earlier in 2019, she'd had a hip surgery, where she was released back onto the street, and she was never very far away from the community house, and grateful to come inside and grab a couch, and also just a feisty, wonderful, strong woman. But she couldn't walk very well for the last few months, so she stayed put. In the middle of July, there were a bunch of campers on a fence line near the school there, and they were swept in the middle of July, and she lost all of her meds that day. She was on a series of 8 or 9 medications, pain, mental health, diabetes, an antidepressant, but she lived her last days without them because they couldn't get them back for those 10 days. Apparently, there's a rule that you can come back and sweep again without notice if you've swept within 10 days that area, so they don't have to give that 48-hour warning. So that happened on the 24th of July. Rapid response came. Debbie was the only person there, but she was in her tent. The folks at Rapid Response noted her as deceased and did not attempt to revive her. There was no ambulance. And they declared that she had been dead for some number of hours, but what I know is it had been an hour or...
So we're literally sweeping people as they're dying now.
Yep, that's what happened. And then at the end of the evening, she was disappeared into a police car, and all the police disappeared at once, and nobody said anything to anybody. I think it was a van that they put her in, like an unmarked van. Everybody just drove away at once, and then Rapid Response was still there, and they finished their sweep. Debbie's husband, Scott, had not been present, and he came just as Rapid Response was about to pull away and saw all of his stuff there on the truck. So his attention and emotions went to needing his things. And then I had to be the one to tell him that his wife had just died, and while I was doing that, Rapid Response left.
With his belongings?
Yes, yeah. Luckily, we were having dinner that night, so he came in, got a shower. We were able to stay with him through the evening and get him basic gear. But we learned that her body was at the Clackamas Medical Examiner. We asked if we could come see. You know, Scott wanted to see Debbie, and we were not allowed.
Why wasn't he even called to identify her?
I don't know why. He was never allowed to see her body after she died. So the last time he saw her was alive when he had left that morning. The way he was treated to not get information easily. He needed to chase it all, which meant that, you know, I partnered with him and we got what we needed, but it took a lot. So we did a fundraiser for him and for her.
Because otherwise they would have kept her remains.
In Oregon, yeah, you don't have a right to remains if you're the next of kin. Somebody has to pay for both the transportation and then the processing of the remains. And so we found somebody who could do that, and we asked our neighbors, and we're able to fund it. But it costs about $800, $850 for, like, the cheapest version of transportation and a box of ashes. But that meant a lot to Scott, I believe.
I spoke briefly with Debbie's husband, Scott Rupp.
How have you been doing?
Been okay. This lost. You know, I've been with her 37 years, and I don't know now. You know, it's just July 16th, they came by and swept her camp and took everything we owned. She kept all her stuff in a rollaway cart with all her clothes and stuff like that, and all our medication. And I wasn't able to get anything back till July 28th. She'd already passed away July 24th, though. She was a person. She's a human being. She was my wife, man. She was somebody. It's Debbie Beaver, Debbie Ann Beaver.
I spoke with vigil organizer Sandra Comstock about the sweeps.
If people are complaining about bio waste, people are complaining about trash, let's have trash pickup like house people get. Let's have places for people to use the bathroom, and let's have places where people can sleep so that they're not in the quote-unquote right of way.
Let's have universal housing.
Exactly.
At the December 19th City Council meeting, a vote on the five-year $22.5 million new contract to sweep Portland's encampments was tabled. On December 20th, an ad hoc coalition calling itself Stop the Sweeps PDX held a press conference in front of City Hall with groups like Street Roots and Sisters of the Road calling for a moratorium on the sweeps until the entire sweeps cleanup process can be reexamined. Take a few minutes today to call the mayor's office at 503-823-4120 and tell them to stop the sweeps. Sweeps endanger the lives of countless chronically ill and medically fragile houseless people in our midst, depriving them of life-saving medications and medical devices they are routinely unable to retrieve. While Debbie was only one of some 82 people who died houseless in the City of Roses this year, her death arguably marks a new low, one in which the dead or dying can be swept away along with their tents, and one in which indigent people are routinely forced to pay ransom to access the mortal remains of their loved ones. Under the auspices of the Oregon Indigent Remains Program, which I'll be doing a follow-up segment on, this segment is dedicated to the memory of Debbie Ann Beaver. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
That was a snippet of Mozart's Requiem in D. And before that, Desiree Helligers with a segment in honor of the memory of Debbie Ann Beaver, one of the more than 80 houseless people to die this past year on the streets of Portland. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our last segment on today's show is The Left and the Law, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discussing sexual harassment by powerful men.
Well, Mike, this 2019 has been a star-studded year for the long lineup of powerful men confronting the wrath of women in court. The Harvey Weinstein case this month was settling for $25 million with women in a tentative agreement with dozens of his sexual misconduct victims, and a deal that would not require the Hollywood producer to admit wrongdoing, to pay anything to his accusers himself, according to his lawyers. So, Mike, let's start with Harvey Weinstein as a big Hollywood story this year, and he's been in the courts quite a lot, but also obviously has big coffers, or his insurance company has big coffers for payouts. Tell us about how you would assess this settlement, and is it an advance or a retreat with respect to the fight against sexism and sexual harassment?
Harvey Weinstein has been doing this and been paying out for it for many decades. Just this year, though, it really became a deal, a thing. In London, for example, he had paid out several $100,000 in the 1990s to a woman who had worked as his sexual assistant.
A sexual assistant?
Pardon me.
It was like barely a Freudian slip. I was like a lawyer speak, right?
Exactly.
His unwilling sexual assistant. Continue with your story.
And she had to sign a non-disclosure agreement that was beyond draconian. She couldn't even think thoughts in her sleep. It was so all-inclusive. And in May of this year, the English equivalent of the Bar Association chastised and punished the law firm that had designed this non-disclosure agreement. It was seen.
So how is it different? I'm having to sign one myself earlier in my career. They're pretty strict in terms of you can't, you know, no, neither speak to this your children nor their children and so on and so forth. How could this be stricter than the ones that are in place here?
Well, I'm not altogether sure, but they found that one of the features it had is a feature that allows non-disclosure agreements to further practices by serial predators like Harvey Weinstein or Steve Wynn in Las Vegas, is that it doesn't surface anywhere. It doesn't surface with regulatory bodies. It doesn't surface in the way that, say, complaints of misconduct against a psychologist are recorded, even if their details are not. Their existence of this is recorded.
So this was like a complete banishment of this,
right?
Charges from any record whatsoever, in a way.
Right. It really highlights the disadvantages of non-disclosure agreements, which are, in their nature, not a bad thing. In fact, silence is golden for people who, whether they want to reform themselves and stop or continue doing the same thing, in either case, silence is a valuable commodity.
And they're also, for those making claims, there is some protection sometimes in privacy, too, because a well-known phenomenon associated with filing sexual harassment claims is that women who are typically the plaintiffs are punished severely in their careers. So there is some degree of privacy, of protection of the privacy for those making claims. Would you agree with that?
Yes, of course. But where they really fall down was the highlight about what happened to Steve Wynn. Steve Wynn was the most powerful man in Las Vegas. Some people credit him with inventing modern Las Vegas, the transition from like a slot machine warehouse to a casino that's a full, quote, experience, close quotes.
American experience, by the way, quintessentially.
Yeah, very popular all around the world. People go there to...
Okay, fair enough.
But he has paid out dozens of complaints because he routinely takes advantage of people who give him massages and the lower level workers in Las Vegas, and he's been doing that for ages. And he made the mistake of trying to build a huge $3 billion resort in Massachusetts, and the regulatory board there asked to review all the papers of the casino in his casinos in Las Vegas, and he granted it to them. And they turned up this long train of non-disclosure agreements, which highlights the serious problem with non-disclosure agreements if they're not recorded anywhere, like with the regulatory body who looks over casinos in Las Vegas, and they are very closely looked at. Their behavior in many ways is studied. And the fact that they did not know about these NDAs made it possible for him to continue doing the same thing for a long, long time. Then it all surfaced in 2018. He had to resign from the board. But this enabled, they sort of facilitated his position of power and his abuse of it for decades.
The payout system and the limits and potential of going to the courts for justice seem to reflect the broader problems in capitalist societies, both the men who are powerful enough to make these deals and to advance careers and open doors and crush people in the process, also have the means to pay out at these levels. So how do you separate the enormous wealth and inequality as it finds its way into the court in these settlements, including the way in which it's tempting to take a very, you know, these millions of dollars as incentives versus the everyday struggles of people, including women who are fighting this sort of thing with men who don't have means for these payouts.
Well, it's like every other aspect of life. If you've got huge amounts of money, there are solutions, there are ways and means to get where you want to go. I mean, overall, we've made tremendous progress. I mean, the casting couch is no longer a funny joke. Cartoons published in Saturday Evening Post of men chasing their secretaries in between the desks, those kind of cartoons, that attitude that it's all just boys being boys, is gone forever. And there are all sorts of ways of being attentive to this problem. But having said all that, it's true. If you've got infinite amounts of money, you can get things done.
Well, let's talk about the film Bombshell as perhaps a story that I think Hollywood film, now in theaters based on the sexual harassment case against Fox News and Roger Ailes specifically, but I think in some ways has both those progressive currents you're describing, but also is very conventional in many ways. And in some ways, I see it as not a particularly feminist film, depending on which feminism you draw on. So just as a little background, for those who haven't seen it, Bombshell is directed by Jay Roach and written by Charles Randolph, starring Charlize Theron, Nicole Kidman, and Margot Robbie, and is based upon the accounts of several women at Fox News who set out to expose CEO Roger Ailes for sexual harassment. And then the film unfolds around scenes where you see a very ailing and homely old man who's only instrument of getting his way in the world is his sheer power, doing very much what you're describing, like the acting, like the director's scene, you know, in old films where, you know, he asks her to strip down and sometimes has his way with her to get the part. And it's very much those kinds of scenes. There's nothing subtle in his behavior. And so in one sense, I think it's kind of an easy film to accept as portraying hideously exploitive behavior. It also plays on, you know, the woman who we see most under his coercion is this very blonde, young Christian woman who's kind of the embodiment of Hollywood's notion of the classic virgin who's humiliated to have to do the service of this homely old man. So there's kind of an element of dirty old man meets the young white virgin. And so it doesn't really push you to have to think about how women are implicated or being drawn into the seductions of power.
Well, it has sort of a catalog, I think, of sexual harassment, ranging from extreme examples of where one woman reports that in order to keep her job, she had to not only sexually service her boss, but also anyone that he directed her to, all the way to people who have opportunities for power where it's an implicit thing that you'll do better, but it's not explicit, and where women have to genuinely wrestle with the idea of do I want to play it safe and have sex, or do I want to take a risk, or how shall I play it? Of course, with Roger Ailes is a classic old troll. If he were a little younger, a little better looking, that would rearrange the equation.
As Henry Kissinger famously said, power is quite an aphrodisiac. Of course, never as much as the powerful man himself imagines. But nonetheless, there was a point there, and here, I mean, for me, the dimension of interest in the film wasn't so much in types of sexual harassment assault, but the whole atmosphere of pimping in Fox News, you know, that the women had to wear push-up bras and high heels, and there was a lot of focus on exposing legs. And so this was also, I think, a transition period where women were making it into anchor news positions based on being smart, but that they had to deliver some pleasure in the process.
Well, that's a Murdoch classic. That's how he's run his papers in London, with page 5 and page 6 of sexy and titillating pictures of women.
Right, and there was a campaign against that page in London, right. And it
the campaign only heightened circulation of the papers in question. It's the insight of Roger Ailes, who was a very smart guy in addition to being a predator, was that conflict like that sells. That's why at first he was fine with Megyn Kelly asking Donald Trump a tough question, because it created conflict and huge buzz and all sorts of social media action and reaction and counter reactions. So the Murdoch template was displayed there. I thought it was like a TV show, and that it was bright colors, as you said, lots of close-ups. It moved quickly along. It had real momentum. It was not at all deep, but you got to see the skeleton of Fox News, the building where they work, you know, the appearance, all of that stuff to me was.
And the symbiotic ties between Trump and Fox News. But these were women who really wanted to work at Fox News, and many of them are very right wing. And that was not relevant. The way in which this form of sexism, the way in which a lot of, and I think this is also true in even evangelical circles, that smart women have to deliver something else around also being childlike or display certain signifiers of femininity in order to be ushered in. And there are certain barriers there that keep women out of the sanctuary of power. The relationship between this mode of highly sexualized femininity and women as sexual objects in that world was not really part of the film. We kind of forgave these women in the film because they were victims for all of the other right-wing positions they take, and maybe that's fair enough, but it...
Well, don't you think, Jan, that it's interesting that it was portrayed precisely at Fox News, which, of course, sexualizes everything from morning show all the way to midnight, all day long. That's part of their shtick. But to show that even in a right-wing environment like that, the same sorts of harassment that exist in every workplace all over America, you know, even in, like, John Deere distributor parts companies, the idea of having to put out for advancement is one that's not by any means confined to TV. But the fact that it was illustrated here by this hotbed of ideological right-wing defiant rejection of the ordinary world that Fox News is, it's a factor of every single part of life.
Right. Yeah, but not in the same way it is on Fox News. So I think, and the mechanisms for going after these predators in different contexts, maybe this is a point for another program, but I think there's a cost to this idea of it's all the same everywhere. It happens everywhere. Yes, of course, sexism and the sexual exploitation of women is pervasive in patriarchal societies, but there is a specific dialect of that in right-wing circles, and the way women are sexually objectified in many right-wing circles, that I think there is more grounds for resisting it in more progressive circles. Of course, it happens. I mean, even Harvey Weinstein, the outrage about what he was doing in so-called liberal Hollywood, where there is really a serious effort to address the objectification of women. And I do we see those same changes on Fox News? I don't know. But the way in which that version of sexuality for women is commercialized in the right-wing media, I think was not itself part of the story.
True.
Okay, well, what about the continuum of these things? Oh, to win against a lawyer appoint. I think you just got worn down. What about in closing, there's a continuum of these cases that perhaps gets swept aside in the larger stories, the story of Harvey Weinstein and his outrageous abusive behavior. There is a continuum of behaviors under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act that can be difficult to recognize, that not all of these situations are the same in terms of their potential harms as well.
Well, many things are surfacing now, like someone like Jeffrey Epstein, who worms his way into MIT media labs, the Congress, museums, the loftiest institutions in the country.
Not anymore.
By providing opportunities for these people to have sex with attractive young women. He was a pimp on a mega scale. And there have been people like that around for a long time. But now we know about them. And we know a lot more about the way sexual harassment works. We know there are some people, like Harvey Weinstein was a complex case because he sponsored and allowed a lot of very liberal, very advanced political movies to be made. A lot of deep, you know, examinations of human behavior. And he would usually mess them up a little bit, like in the movie Frida, Selma Hayek's project. He financed it. It was not an obvious financial winner for Hollywood.
Frida Kahlo.
Yes. But he insisted that there be a sex scene in it, which seemed rather strange in the context of the movie. You know, Selma Hayek is always good to look at, but still it seemed to jar with the whole arc of the way the narrative was going. So people stuck with him for a longer time. But now we see his whole career. We know a lot about him. He's going to be undergoing different reviews in district attorney's offices for criminal behavior.
And then there's, I think, one final question often that arises, whether these huge payouts and public disgrace and banishment from an industry are sufficient, or whether these people should all end up in prison. And I think there is debate about that. So we'll probably have plenty to still cover in 2020 with these guys. So this is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking today, a review of the year's highlights for sexual predators meeting women in court.
Divided that come together to stand united. The voices of toiling masses gather, our voices heighten. We want our lows lightened, we want our wrongs righted. Any attempt to control our bodies, we poised to fight it. Gon' blame the system, that's accurate. But if we claim our inaction, that's activist. Our body's not a target, yet it's under attack. Forward together, never a single step back.
That was some of NC Music Love Army with My Body Politic. And before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, The Left and the Law, discussing some of this past year's stories of powerful men getting caught in their sexual harassment. You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, and you can find The Left and the Law, along with the rest of today's segments, online in a day or two at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Ready for sharing. I'm Fran Michelle. I've been your host today. Thanks to Patricia Kullberg for engineering, and thanks to Denise Morris and Joe Clement for editing and for the recording of Barbara Mattaloni's comments on how strikes work. Thanks to Desiree Helligers for her report from the December 21st Portland Homeless Persons Memorial Day Vigil about the life and death stakes in the upcoming city council vote on a $22.5 million five-year contract for rapid response to ramp up their already horrifying and deadly sweeps of the city's houseless encampments. You can call Portland's Mayor Ted Wheeler at 503 503-823-4120 to tell him to stop the sweeps. That's 503-823-4120. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Marie-Rose Turek for their conversation about taking over California's evil energy corporation, Pacific Gas and Electric. And thanks to you, KBOO listeners and members. We'll be back next year with more from the Mole's underground grassroots perspective.